Welcome to the next session here in the class on Ecclesiastes, Searching for the Meaning of Life. We concluded last time at the end of chapter 3, and we're going to push on into the next chapter, chapter 4, which kind of follows on the heels of chapter 3 with Solomon, the presumed author, making his observations about what he sees in the world and coming to some pretty drastic conclusions about it. But there is a little hint and flare of optimism, though, that he places in as well. And we'll see that come back here in chapter 4. But he launches off in chapter 4 here and lists 4 problems with the world that he sees. So let's get into the text. At the beginning of Ecclesiastes chapter 4, it says, "Then I turned and saw," and this is kind of just the language that Solomon uses to say that he's now going to be presenting kind of a new subject. "Then I turned and I saw all the oppressions that are done under the sun." So that's his focus here, oppression. "And behold, the tears of those who were oppressed, and they had no comforter. On the side of their oppressors, there was power, and they had no comforter." The first problem here with oppression, this is an extension of where we finished last time. In chapter 3, we were talking about injustice. Social injustice, particularly. And Solomon kind of critiques the idea that there was no justice. Well, where he thought you would find it, there was wickedness. And then where he thought there'd be righteousness, there wasn't. There was evil. And oppression here, this is a very broad term for any type of activity, such as exploitation, can be robbery, fraud, abuse of power, any type of disenfranchisement, physical assault, and violence, confiscation of property, social prejudice, unfair dealings, and so on and so forth. The basic sense is that those who have power use it to their advantage and perpetrate it on those who are less powerful or are vulnerable, particularly in society in the ancient world. That would have been widows, that would have been orphans, that would have been foreigners, and people who lived in poverty. To say it another way, oppression would just be to deny personal rights and justice, and often accompanied by some sort of violent means or harm done to the individual. All oppression is essentially selfish in its nature. It's seeking the benefit of yourself or your interests and using your ability to achieve them without regard to anybody else's needs, well-being, or rights. And as I mentioned before, typically the other person is harmed in some way in the process, either physically or in other material ways or in their reputation and so on. Power, no matter what form it takes, whether we're talking in economic power, political power, religious power, that it's not to be used for selfish advancement. Here, the people who are oppressing others, the people who are oppressed are crying out. They're filled with tears. Solomon sees the pain that is being caused to them by these people who are trying to advance themselves. It ends up turning people into objects. Oppression looks to use people to be able to achieve what you desire rather than looking out for what they need or for their well-being. So if this is the way that Solomon sees the world, it might bring to mind a potential proverb in Proverbs 14:31. It says, "The person who oppresses the poor taunts the one who created him, but the person who shows favor to the needy glorifies him." And there's no comforter. So Solomon is seeing just the miserable condition of those who are oppressed, and that this is actually an assault, not on these people only, but actually on God himself, the creator of these people. And so with this position, he then says, okay, I'm looking around and I see all of this suffering. So then he concludes in verse 2, "Well, therefore, I praise the dead who had already died. And he does it more than the living who are still alive. And better off than them both is the one who has not yet been," that means not yet been born, "who's not seen the evil things that are done under the sun." Now, Solomon is clearly exaggerating here. He's not thinking that non-existence is actually the best thing there is beyond being alive and having to be in this broken world where this suffering occurs. He's trying to elevate his horror at this is the state of things as he looks around under the sun. That he uses this term, that it's better to be dead, he says, than to the people who are currently going through this oppression. And even he says beyond that, it's better that somebody just never actually happened. And that somebody didn't actually be born to have to witness these atrocities. I don't know if he could have made any stronger point about how horrified he is that this is what happens under the sun. Now, in verse 3 here, this better off than, he actually uses this phrase 4 times in chapter 4. So this is the first time he comes across and uses it in a comparative sense. We'll see 3 more. As we move on to the next section, which is his next problem, and this is the problem of rivalry. And we see here, he says, then I saw, so we know that Solomon is now turning to examine another condition that he sees. Then I saw that all labor and skillful work is the rivalry of one person with another. This also is pointless and hurting the wind. He turns to, and he says, if all of these people are trying to get ahead of other people by oppressing them, he looks at all the hard work then that is being done, and which people then try to take things and exploit things from the hard work and labor of people. He says, well, what motivates everybody to be doing this? And to his shock and amazement, he says that he thinks it's rivalry. He thinks it's one person against another who wants to get ahead of their neighbor, outdo their competitor, or be preferred above everyone else. Again, we can see that this is likely an exaggeration of Solomon to make a point, because it's hard to imagine that everybody on the planet who works hard is doing it from a basis of rivalry as their motivating factor. Nevertheless, I think we probably can say that rivalry does play a large factor in a lot of competitive business in the world, and people who work hard and try to be better than others. Now, this section is linked to the previous section in the sense that people who often oppress others, they do so in order to try to get ahead. And so rivalry ends up being, in a sense, tied to the act of oppression. People push others down so that they can then climb higher. And in the pursuit of climbing this ladder of success, people don't mind kicking others' heads who are beneath them in order to keep them down and make sure they're moving upward. In Solomon's view here, rivalry is what motivates this work, and he sees it as being pointless, as a pointless endeavor. And so then perhaps he might, you know, logically then, hearing him might logically conclude that, well, perhaps it's then better not to work. What if we just don't work then, if it's all about rivalry and there's this all this oppression happening? To this consideration, he then brings forward 2 proverbs to answer that. The first one, in verse 5, he says, the fool folds his hands together and eats his own flesh. So this would be the person who would conclude, well, maybe it's best not to work. If this is why everybody's working so hard, is to try to get ahead of everybody else. And so he said, well, the fool takes that track. The fool folds his hands together, which is a way of saying that he's lazy. He's idle. He doesn't do anything. He doesn't apply himself. He folds his hands together and just sits there. And the result is he eats his own flesh. Now, I don't think anybody would see that as being, well, that's a positive outcome then for that behavior. This type of self-cannibalism is meant to show that it's destructive, that type of attitude of the folding of the hands and of being idle and lazy is actually self-destructive. Now, if it's not refraining from work, then perhaps in verse 6, he says, well, better, there's a second better than phrase, better is a handful of rest, rather than the folding of the hands, than 2 fists full of labor and hurting the wind. So what he's trying to do is he's trying to point to the extremes here of it's not non-work, and it's not 2 fists full of work, meaning you're doing everything you can to get ahead, saying it's better to have a handful of rest which implies that there's also a corresponding handful of work that's done. But there's a balance between the two, and it's better to have rest with some work than all work and no rest, because that is hurting the wind. It's pointless, he says. All this trying to get ahead of everybody else, it doesn't mean anything. All right, so that's the second problem. The third problem we encounter in verse 7, then I turned and saw, that's his phrase there, that he's now considering a new topic, new subject. Then I turned and saw another pointless thing under the sun. Now, what is that? Well, he says there's one person who has no other. Essentially, he has no one else. He neither has a son or a brother, so he has no siblings and he has no children. Yet there is no end to all his labor. So Solomon observes him that he works really hard, but he's completely alone. And then he does all this work and says, but his eyes, nor are his eyes satisfied with wealth. So his eyes aren't satisfied by the fruit of all of his work, all the wealth that he's gaining. He's not satisfied with it. Then he asks this question. This is like from the point of view of this lonely person who has no one else. This is the question that he would then say, for whom then do I labor and deprive my soul of pleasure? If the person has nobody else, they're a loner. They're isolated. They basically are working and working and working. But then they ask, like, why am I doing all this work? I have no one else here to share any of this wealth with. And I don't even really want all this wealth. It's not what satisfies me. And I'm depriving my soul of pleasure. Now, the idea of pleasure means to have rest and enjoy life. This isn't some like entertainment pleasure necessarily or sexual pleasure. It's just enjoying life. It seems that he's devoted to work, but he doesn't know why he works so much because he is alone. And Solomon sees this as this is pointless, he says. It's pointless for some single person who's all by themselves with no community to labor and labor and labor and gain all this wealth and be miserable because they aren't satisfied with the product of all their work. They don't want all the wealth. Well, they might, but when they get it, they really don't. It doesn't fill them the way that they thought it would. And he'll talk about the emptiness of wealth. That's a big theme he gets to here. But this is pointless and a miserable business. So Solomon here in this third problem he sees is it's terrible for somebody to just be all alone in the world, working hard and gaining wealth, and they just are completely by themselves. He says that's pointless and that's miserable. The fourth problem, verse 9 says, two are better than one. So here's another better than phrase, because they have a good wage for their labor. For if they fall, the one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him who is alone when he falls and does not have another to lift him up. What Solomon's going to do here is he's going to give several examples of loneliness and the problem with it. He's going to do it by showing the advantage of having more than one. And he does this in a way to show the benefit and the value of community, whether it's family community or it's like social community. It's better not to be alone is his bottom line. It does that through three different scenarios. One scenario that deals with help, another one that deals with warmth, and then the third one, which deals with strength or security. So the first one here, two are better than one, for if, and then the first scenario, if you have somebody who falls, and this is more than just you're going down the sidewalk and you catch your toe, you trip, you stumble, and you fall. People can readily raise themselves back up from a little stumble and fall on the sidewalk. What he has in mind here is if you're on like a journey and you're in some treacherous terrain and you somehow slide down into a ravine or you fall into a sinkhole pit or something where you can't get out very easily. But if somebody was able to reach down and give you assistance, you'd be able to recover your position and be able to come out of that pit, hole, or wherever you were much easier than the struggle you would have if you did it on your own. So it's better to have someone there that can help you. Now, I think this could probably extend to a lot of different areas in life. I think that every time I go to move a couch, I pretty much don't want to do it by myself. I know that's way beyond the means of my strength. It always goes better if you have two people at least lifting this heavy object. So if you're in an adverse situation, two people are always better than one. That's his point. Now, it's also good for two people if one of them has a problem staying warm. And that's the next thing. He says, also, if two lie together, this is his second scenario. If two lie together, then they keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? Now, this lie together, it just means that they're in the same bed proximity, lying down together. No sexual overtones or anything or insinuation by that. I mean, you guys probably, I don't know if you've ever been in a scenario where you've been maybe outdoors and you're sitting somewhere and you're cold. You have people that huddle up next to you and you're trying to get warm by being close together in proximity to each other, pushing your shoulders up together and trying to stay warm. Because when you're closer together, you can share warmth. This is a common tactic in survival. I don't know if anybody's ever been in a life-threatening situation where somebody's body temperature has dropped, like if they're suffering hypothermia, but it is a common practice for survival that another person joins the person who's suffering hypothermia to try to warm them back up to regain proper body temperature. And this is often done by two people being in a sleeping bag together, usually with very little clothes on, in order to promote the conduction of heat between the two. Solomon's simple point is just that if you're cold and you're by yourself, you're just going to be cold. But if you have someone else, then you can share warmth. Each other's bodies can help to contribute to a warm environment. All right, lastly, the third one here, verse 12. And if a man can overpower the one, it's about somebody who's getting overpowered, two can withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken. So the scenario here would be if you're by yourself and somebody comes, like an assailant, somebody comes to attack you. If you're by yourself, then the only line of defense you have is to defend yourself with whatever you're capable of doing yourself. And so if the other person is bigger, stronger, maybe has a weapon, you're at a disadvantage. But if you have more than one person, now you might have the advantage on your side. I mean, consider for a moment, if you're walking down a dark alley at night, maybe some of you have done this, do you feel very secure or safe if you're just walking down that alley by yourself? I don't know about you, but sometimes I feel a little uncomfortable being in places like that by myself, just in case something would happen. And I would be surprised by somebody who was bigger than me or who had a weapon. But if I was walking down that alley with, let's say, like a 300-pound linebacker, I'd probably feel a little bit more comfortable having somebody big and strong. I mean, if I had the whole offensive line walking with me, I'd be willing to go anywhere. Having the presence of other strong people is what brings more strength than what you can provide on your own. As the change here from the two people can withstand him to then the threefold cord is not quickly broken, this is likely a use of a numerical parallelism, which is a common technique in wisdom literature, where it is showing an amplification by using a number and then adding one more to it to just show that if it's really true that two people can withstand somebody who's attacking, then imagine how much better it would be if you had three people. If two can be successful and two can withstand him, then three, nobody stands a chance. Three is so much stronger. All right, so that's the three examples of why being alone is not good, but being in community or being with other people is better. Let's go on to verse 13. And 13 here, this is the beginning of the next problem. So this is the fourth problem. The fourth problem is about power and popularity. In verse 13, it says, better. This is the fourth and final statement of the better than comparative phrases. Better is a poor but wise youth than an old and foolish king who no longer knows to regard advice. For out of prison he came to be king, even though he was born poor in his kingdom. So what Solomon is trying to say through this problem he sees is that, well, if you're an old king, you should have years of experience. But an old and experienced king who is a fool because he refuses to listen to advice, that it's better to have somebody who's poor and wise and young than that person rule. And then here, the person who's poor, he was born poor in the kingdom, but then rises up to replace the king. Now, what he's showing here is that there's a replacement going on with the old foolish king and the poor and wise youth. But then in 15, he says, and I saw all the living who are walking about under the sun, that they were with the next youth who replaced him. So Solomon is not just looking at the old foolish king replaced by the poor and wise youth who started out from humble means, but then rose up to become king. But then there's another person who then comes and replaces him, another youth, another young person. Then he says, there was no end to all the people, even to all those whom he was over. Yet those who come later will not rejoice in him. The person who's being described here is the next young ruler who came, that even though all the people he was over, that there was no end to all the people. He ruled over everyone, and he had popularity. He became the king and ruled over everyone, and everyone was coming to him. But the ones who come later will not rejoice in him, meaning that he will not have their favor. And what Solomon is trying to point out here is that popularity and having political power is fleeting. That you might have it, you might be king one day, and then the next you're not. You're replaced by a young, wise, poor person. And then that person gets replaced by some other young person. And everybody seems to like him, but then the people who come later, they don't praise him. They don't rejoice in him. They don't prefer him. The sense of the passage here that Solomon's trying to impress upon the reader is that the old foolish king being replaced by the young wise youth who came from humble beginnings, who then is replaced by another youth who has popularity and who followed him, but that the popularity only was short-lived, that this is all pointless, that trying to have popularity and power, that nobody's able to hold on to that. It comes and it goes. And so here he says, surely this also is pointless and hurting the wind, because you can't keep it. In one moment you might have it, but then you don't the next. These things are transitory. And that's Solomon's point, is to show that popularity is transitory and power is transitory. I think we probably see some of this in our own lives, where we might discuss leadership of different sorts with people. And you might notice that there are generational differences, meaning that one generation might like a certain style of leadership or a certain leader themselves. And then another generation doesn't like that person, but likes someone else, likes a different leadership style, likes to see another person be in charge. I think that this is what happens a lot with presidents. People favor certain presidents, certain political regimes. And then as the generations go, different attitudes and different mindsets come about. And this is all what's pointless about it, Solomon says, is that it just shifts and changes when the people come. The people who come later, they don't want to rejoice in the former people. They have a different preference. So this is all about the transitoriness of the world that he sees regarding popularity and power. All right, we're going to move on to chapter 5. And actually, Solomon's going to digress here for a little bit about worship. So we're going to look here at the first few verses of chapter 5 and look at what he has to say about worship. So this is kind of an aside that Solomon is stepping away from his normal observational data that he's trying to share. Okay, verse 1, guard your step. So he said, this is what he's telling the reader. Guard your step when you go to the house of God, the temple. And if this was around the time of Solomon, this would have been the temple that he built, Solomon's temple that David began and then passed on to his son to complete. Go near to listen rather than to offer the sacrifice of fools, for they do not recognize that they are doing evil. The first instruction here, to go to guard your step and then go near to listen. In wisdom literature, this is very important, is the act of listening. There's so many times, like in the book of Proverbs, where the son is exhorted by his father to listen to my instruction. And we just read that the reason why the poor wise youth was preferred is because the old king was foolish. He becomes stubborn, obstinate. He refused to listen to advice. So he says, when you come to the house of God, go near to listen than to rather than to offer sacrifices of fools. The sacrifice of fools, which is basically somebody coming to offer the sacrifice and not really thinking through everything that it means, and also being very clumsy about it. Solomon's trying to press weight upon what it means to approach God. When you come to the house of God, you are approaching the presence of God. God was said to dwell in the house of God between the cherubim over top of the ark. And then next he says in verse 2, do not be rash with your mouth, and do not let your heart be hasty to utter a word in God's presence, for God is in heaven and you are on earth. Therefore, let your words be few. Now, Solomon's not saying, don't talk to God too much. God, you don't want to bore God with your words. He's saying you need to be mindful of what you say to God. And this is particularly with reference to vows, as we'll see in the next couple verses, that you don't want to speak something to God haphazardly. Don't just want to kind of like fly off the cuff and just sort of like utter things in God's presence that you really maybe don't mean. In verse 3, for as a dream comes when there is a multitude of cares, so the voice of a fool comes with a multitude of words. The idea here is that you can have a lot of work, a lot of cares in the world, and that might fatigue you, and then that produces dreams. And likewise, a fool comes from somebody who just runs their mouth. There's a lot of proverbs about this. One that comes to my mind is Proverbs chapter 10, verse 19. When there are many words, wrongdoing is unavoidable, but one who restrains his lips is wise. So to know when to say something and when not to say something is wisdom. But the fool just runs their mouth, and by doing so and speaking many words, sin or wrongdoing is unavoidable. Okay, and then the last verses we're going to check out here in this section, verses 4 through 7. When you vow a vow to God, it's like if you're in the house of God and you're speaking to God, when you make a vow, do not delay in paying it, meaning accomplishing it or fulfilling it. For he has no pleasure in fools. For God has no pleasure in fools who just run their mouth and say things but don't really mean them. What you vow, pay. So if you say you're going to give something to God, you're going to honor God in such and such a way, well, then you better make good on what you just told God. Don't say it, but then not mean it. You have to follow through, is what Solomon is saying. Let your words be few. Think through what you're going to say. Mean what you say. Fulfill your vows. It's better that you should not vow than that you should vow and not pay. So here's in chapter 5, there's already a better than phrase here. It's better to do this, which means don't even make a vow to God, than to make a vow and then just completely fault on it and not pay up. Do not let your mouth cause your whole body to sin, like we just read about in Proverbs, that speaking can lead to sin, but it's wise to restrain your lips. Do not say before the messenger that it was a mistake. Oh, I didn't mean to actually tell God that I was going to do this or that. I was going to pay this. I was going to offer this sacrifice. I don't know what I was thinking. It was a mistake. Sorry. He says, don't do that. Don't tell the messengers it was a mistake that you made a vow. Why should God be angry at your voice and destroy the work of your hands? Why would you provoke God? Why would you tell God that you're going to do something and then actually betray him by failing to follow through and do it? Verse 7 says, for in many dreams and in many words, there is much that is pointless. So in a lot of work that you do, all the cares and concerns that produce dreams because of how much you labor, And also how much you say, the words that you use, involved in both of those is a world of things that are pointless. In contrast to all of that, Solomon's final exhortation here in verse 7 is, rather fear God. And this correlates with a lot of what wisdom says about living with the fear of God. Actually, in Proverbs, wisdom and the fear of God are intimately connected because the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. And those who they walk on the road of wisdom, they live with the fear of God, the fear of Yahweh, which is not being terrified or afraid of him, but having the proper reverence and respect for him, submitting to his authority and obeying him as the rightful ruler and king of the cosmos. So that's how Solomon concludes the end of this section with an exhortation to not be busy about with all the work and everything that brings and the dreams that can come from overexhaustion, and to not be running your mouth and saying many words and trying to act like you're important by making vows in the house of God. He's like, just fear God, submit to him and obey him and follow his commandments. So we're going to conclude here for the session, and then we'll pick back up in chapter 5 and verse 8 next time.